Halloween night, 31st of October, and welcome to the LSE. My name is Ricky Burdett. I'm director of the Cities Program here at the LSE. Delighted to welcome you and to welcome someone who actually frightens me to introduce, because he was my professor and my teacher 23 years ago, Bill Hillier, who is going to talk about a subject which I think interests all of us, whether we're involved in cities, programs, design, economic analysis, or anything else, because he's going to talk about that fundamental thing which creates the environment in which we live, which is cities, which is space. And he's entitled it provocatively, Space Matters. The hard thing to say is how it matters. Bill Hillier is, in fact, the only professor, as far as I know, of architectural and urban morphology. He happens to be at University College London. And the reason is very simple. He sort of invented it to a degree. The whole notion of studying the space, the form, the shapes of that which is between and outside the walls of buildings, the streets, the public spaces. And there he pioneered in the 70s a group which has now expanded worldwide, centered on the notion of space syntax, the grammar of space, the grammar and the understanding of the interconnections of spaces, which is founded, and that is what he's really going to be talking primarily about tonight, on a theory of urban space and the structure of space and its relationship to society. Now, the LSE Cities Program, as some of you know, is really predicated on the notion that there is a connection between space and society. Some people still are amazed by that bizarre statement, and others have been working on it. Many are in this room. From, in a way, both sides of the fence, from the architectural and urban design side and from the social science planning and social theory side. And I think Bill has been consistent over the last 30 years in the work he has done in trying to build an original theory which links these two worlds of society and space. In fact, it's a theory which, unlike, I think, many others that I'm aware of, many others that many of the students involved in our collective courses here study, which has really impacted on mainstream urban design and architecture. There are few architects, and I think Bill will probably not talk about this tonight, certainly in this country, who lift their pen, so to speak, or their computer mouse without asking Bill, will my public space work? And that's why I think behind his title is a much larger message which is of great interest to those of us who are students of space and spatial organization and significantly its spatial impacts. Now, I, as a student 23 years ago, Bill, thought that I was getting onto a really original thing when I could use the P word at dinner parties, permeability. No one knew what that was. Integration, connectivity, words which I have to say, and I'm sure many of you would agree, are now very much part of the common language of planning, regeneration, and design. And I think there's no doubt that to a degree they've been given a certain precision and a certain clear definition in terms of their role in the making of spaces and trying to make spaces successful by the work that Bill Hillier and his colleagues at the Bartlett School of Architecture have been doing. And I think in the space of only 20 years, that is an extraordinary feat. Bill and I have talked a lot about this lecture. He's very kindly, with his colleagues, talked at the LSE before, within the courses that we run in the Cities program. We've talked about a lot about this lecture as to, in a way, what its status is and why he wants to talk about it. I mean, Bill has been thinking about these things for a long time. And tonight, he is very interested in raising some of the theoretical issues and engaging with you, possibly after his talk and through questions and discussion, in this fundamental issue of the relationship between space and society at a theoretical level. So I very much look forward to this synthesis of 30 years' work, Bill. I know it's tough to do it in an hour or so, but will you please join me in welcoming Bill Hillier to the LSE.
This is not the synthesis of the last 30 years' work, it's the synthesis of the next 30 years' work. And I'm glad you stopped before you gave the lecture. Thank you very much, anyway. In the context of this lecture is the LSE Cities Programme, whose central objective, as I read it, is to relate the physical structure to the social structure of cities. This is the problem that is shared by architecture and the social science, and this is why it is so exciting there should be a cities programme in the home of the social sciences. But does the social city really relate to the physical city? Does it need it? Does it depend on it in any sense? How should we seek to answer such a question? The most natural assumption is that since cities are the products of social and economic activity rather than the other way around, then our strategy of inquiry ought to be to approach the physical through the social, that is to examine patterns of social and economic activity and try to find the city and their output. This social city first approach has been dominant in academic life in the last 20 years and has given us many insights into cities, but more, as might be expected, into the social city than the physical city. I do not believe that I will be treading on anyone's toes if I say that we still lack the theoretical understanding of the physical city as an intricate and complex physical and spatial object that we need if, as designers, we are to intervene in the workings more effectively than we did in the 20th century. How should we then seek to complement our understanding of the social city through the social sciences with a better understanding of the physical city and its relation to the social city? I suspect that a philosophical problem has hindered us in the past. Precisely because the built environment is a physical thing, we tend to think of it as no more than that. It leads us to presume that, like the natural environment, it is simply the background and context for human activity. As soon as we see it as background, it is very hard to conceive how space could possibly affect the human activity that goes on in the foreground. It sounds like a very strange kind of determinism. However, if the huge flowering in recent years of studies of space and the built environment in disciplines as varied as anthropology, archaeology, social history, and many more have taught us one thing, it is that our built environment is much more than a background and context of social behaviour. It is itself a social behaviour and can only be understood when embedded in its social context. This changes the question. It means that built environments are not just inert material things. They have social contents. The question is how. So if we want to relate the social city to the physical city, there's a second kind of question we can ask. If cities are created by human activity, then they ought in their form to bear the signs of this creation and to reflect its logic in regularities of some kind in how it's constructed. If this is so, then it ought to be possible to find ways of looking at the city to detect the impact of these processes, that is, to discover the social logic of the city by looking first at the city itself. This is the starting point and the paradigm question for my discipline, space syntax. Space syntax is a set of theoretical ideas and methods which aim to understand the links between the social city and the physical city by first addressing ourselves to the physical city and trying to uncover its social logic. Given that the creation of the built environment is a social behaviour, we ask, how is the built environment a social behaviour and why, and does anything follow from this? The question is made more difficult and also scientifically much more interesting by the way in which most cities are created. Cities are emergent phenomena and ought to surprise us much more than they do. Created bottom-up over at least decades and usually centuries by innumerable hands and agencies, cities somehow emerge as apparently well-ordered systems with a life and even a culture of their own. More puzzlingly, cities all over the world have a great deal in common. There are, as we will see, invariants as well as differences between cities. How can this happen? Is it purely or even importantly a physical process that goes on? Are those who create the step-by-step city in some sense knowledgeable agents? In which case, what do they know and how do they know it? And if society does make its mark on the city, then how on earth can this come about? How does society get into these agencies that shape the city this way and that? And do so on the historical scale at least, in a more or less consistent way. Now, I cannot hope to answer all of these questions, and it is exciting that at this time so many disciplines are now seeking to contribute to their solution. For example, when neuroscientists ask how taxi drivers know cities, they are, I am sure, contributing to what we need to know to link the social city to the physical city. However, I do believe that there is a generic key to understanding the physical city as a social object, and that is space, or more precisely, spatial configuration. And I want to make it clear that this, I mean, space in the everyday, ordinary sense of the patterns of space we make inside and outside by the act of building, which we then use and move about in. As physical things, cities are in fact largely made of just two things. Discrete clumps of buildings, which themselves exist to create an organized space internally, and a system of connecting space that links the buildings into a continuous whole. I will try and persuade you that by learning to study the strange patterns that emerge from large numbers of acts of building, and initially to study them as patterns in themselves, we can bring to light at least the generic outlines of the social city and the form of the city itself, that is, in its space. Now, the notion of emergence will be a key to understanding space and understanding cities. I will argue that by understanding how human beings use and make space as individuals, we can begin to see how complex configurations of space emerge without design outside individuals and become in themselves powerful factors in the future pathway of the system, forming the frame for what Giddens calls the interlacing of contexts. This also, I will argue, provides us with a natural framework in which we can identify regularities in the emergent patterns, which must be the outcome of interventions in the growth process by knowledgeable agents or agencies acting on behalf of society. Then through this, we will understand how it is that specific economic and social cultural processes shape the city. The configurational emergence approach to space will, it turns out, lead us not only to a highly practical theory, which can be used in design and planning, but one which challenging the common assumption that space, at best, is just the neutral receptor of whatever society imposes on it. At the emergent level, it seems, space answers back and plays a constructive role in the creation of the living city out of aggregates of buildings. How then can we begin to study space? First, we must bring our first lesson. That's gone too far on. There we are. Our first lesson that space is not just a background down to earth. The first foundation of the space syntax approach is that space is far from being a background to human activity, but is actually an intrinsic aspect of everything that human beings do. And in this, it has its own geometry. For example, if you look at the figure, people move in lines. When they interact in spaces which have the property of convexity. We see complex shapes we call point isovists as we move around cities or buildings. Our experience of space and our use of space has a certain shape and a certain geometry to it. This means that to understand different aspects of human activity, we have to model space or represent it in different ways in terms of different human experiences. For example, if we're studying urban movement, we find that by representing the system as the lines of a street network, we're also representing the elementary logic of how people move. Now, the second foundation of space syntax is the idea of taking different elements, geometrical elements, which relate to how human beings operate in space, subjecting these to measures of configuration, which relate all spatial elements in a system to each other. Technically, configuration in the space syntax definitions means relations that take into account other relations, and probably all the relations in a complex. Look at the figure on the wall, which shows the effect on the intervisibility from all points to all others in a space of simply moving a square object from the center of the space, first to the edge and then the corner. The colour represents a mathematical measure we call visual integration. This is worked out by first covering the space with an arbitrarily fine grid, which I think you can see, then taking the centre of each cell and drawing the shape that you can see from that point. Obviously, close to the object you see less, farther from the object you see more. It then calculates how easy it is to get to see all other points in the space, i.e. how many times you have to take a different position to see points you've not seen before. So visual integration, we see there, is a measure that relates all points to all other points in the space, including those that can't be seen from a particular point. The redder it is, the more visually integrated, the bluer the less. Now all these three spaces with simple squares inside are coloured up on the same scale, so that we can see that as we move the object, not only does the pattern change, a different pattern of visuality emerges, if you like, but the overall quantity of visual integration changes. In effect, if we place a block in the centre of a space, the space is less visually integrated than if you place the object in a corner. This is a mathematical law of space in the form, if we move an object this way, like an urban block, for example, then these are the effects on the emergent configuration. The same is true if we measure what we call metric integration, that is how people move around in a space. If the object is placed centrally, then on average, trips will be longer than if the object is placed peripherally. This may surprise you. It really, you would think things balance themselves out, but they don't. Placing things peripherally does actually make the thing more metrically and visually integrated. So this gives an idea, if you like, of what I call the all points to all others approach to measuring properties of space, the configurational approach. Now consider this little story. A group of people is sitting in armchairs in my daughter's flat. My two-year-old grandson, Freddie, comes into the room with two balloons to attach by weights to two pieces of string about 2.5 feet long. So the balloons are about head height for the sitting people. Looking mischievous, he places the balloons in the center of the space defined by the armchairs so that the balloons are at head height for the sitting adults. After a minute or two, thinking Freddie has lost interest, one of the adults moves the balloons from the center of space to the edge. Freddie, looking even more mischievous, walks over to the balloons and places them back in the center of the room. Everybody understands what's happening, including you. But what is actually happening? Freddie is, of course, using the balloons to intervene in the adult conversation and draw attention to himself. But how he's doing it is interesting, since it seems to apply that both he and adults are aware of what I just presented, that is the if-then laws of space. It is hard to avoid the inference that both Freddie and the adults are knowledgeable agents using space, and in fact spatial laws, to negotiate something social. He not only knows these laws, but he knows how to use this for his own individual and social ends. Now, I'm making this point because key to my argument is the idea that we are knowledgeable agents in space. We do have some understanding, even from a young age, not just of simple elementary things like proxemics, but actually of the configurational properties of space. If you think about Freddie's behavior, although it's centered on himself in some sense, his spatial behavior shows he's thinking not of the impact of placing the balloons on his own point of vision, but those of a whole group of people sitting around the space. He seems to have some kind of objective configurational knowledge of how the space works from all points to all others, since he is reading the space in an all-to-all way. Now, such spatial knowledge is, I think, not surprising, and it's like other forms of non-discursive knowledge, things we know intuitively that we don't know how to talk about analytically. It's no more surprising than with language, where the configurational properties of language, the grammar and the semantic structures, are handled unconsciously but efficiently when we speak and hear, and they are similarly non-discursive. In fact, I think we can probably generalize. Human beings handle a relation or configurational aspects of things as ideas to think with rather than ideas to think of. Maybe because configurational understanding is built into our very conditions of existence as discrete mobile beings whose survival during our evolution depended on reading ambient configurations of other such beings. So configuration, that means understanding complexes of relationships between elements and spaces, is something out there in the real world and also seems to be, to some extent, known or readable here inside the heads of individuals. Now, once we have the two basic ideas I presented, that is, different geometries of space as intrinsic to how human beings act, and configurational measures of the interrelation between all the elements in the complex, we can bring the two together in the basic techniques of space syntax. For example, we can analyze patterns of lines. So here's a pattern of lines which is simply analyzed in terms of the depth of each line to all the others, and then colored up red to blue, red being the most integrating, blue the least integrating. It's very surprising how even very simple complexes produce such differentiations in the configurational values. Or we can take convex elements of space and look at how they relate to each other, again coloring up from red to blue. Or we can take visual fields and take as our basic elements, so the visual fields that people see as they move around cities, and look at how they relate to each other, in always giving this sort of this basic measure of depth from all points to others, which is the basis of the syntax measure of integration. So how then should we analyze urban spatial patterns? And what do we find out when we do so? Looking at town plans, the first thing one notes is that urban space, in spite of rumours to the contrary from generations of theorists who've been fascinated by piazzas, urban space is essentially linear. Nearly all our terms for urban space describe linear spaces, from alley through street to avenue and boulevard, and most spaces in any urban complex are spaces of this kind. The reason for this, as we will see in due course, is the spatial form of cities is really all about movement, and this is the reason why we analyse spatial configurations in cities as networks of lines, and we do then find powerful results. We can both identify what I call deep structures in the city, if I may use a very old-fashioned term, which are manifestly of a social kind, but we can also link these structures that we find to observable functional patterns. How is it then done? Well, supposing we take the figure I've just shown you, which is a small town in France, and represent it as economically as we can as a network of the fewest and longest lines that pass through all the space and make all connections. But then analyse it according to the depth, that is, the number of lines you must pass through to go from each line to all others by the simplest route. And we find this. The computer has identified a pattern from red to blue. I say it's in particular it's defined what I call an integration core of red, orange and yellow spaces. That's the most integrated and the pretty integrated spaces. In a form that we call a deformed wheel, in that there is a hub of lines forming a local semi-grid near the centre, strong spokes in all directions linking centres to edges, and even parts of the rim are part of the integration core. Within the structure of the deformed wheel, as we call it, we find these interstitial areas of red and green, more segregated areas. It's very curious that the computer analysis of a real city has actually identified something like the ancient symbol for the city of a cross within a circle. Once we see the pattern and, of course, know the town, we realise that what the computer has identified as the core, by a purely mathematical analysis of the line pattern, is in fact the pattern of the most public space, where most of the shops are, and where most people are to be found. While the less integrated areas in the interstices formed by the wheel are the purely residential areas. In the light of this, the edge-to-centre structure of the core makes complete sense. The edge-to-centre lines seem designed to access strangers from the point of arrival at the edge of the city to the centre of the city, while the location of the residential areas in the interstices formed by the wheel means that strangers are unlikely to move into or through these areas, so preserving their tranquility. But at the same time, movement from these areas, either to other areas or to destinations within the main public spaces, will find themselves using the same spaces for movement as the stranger. Now, this is quite a subtle effect, for it means that there's both easy access and egress for strangers, but also natural inbuilt surveillance of strangers by inhabitants. It's a kind of a probabilistic kind of relationship between the movement patterns generated by both. We are beginning, it seems, to identify not only structures in space, but also some kind of generic social logic of that spatial structure, where it is constructing a relationship between inhabitants and strangers, but in two modes, one to interface with strangers, the other to avoid strangers. And I think this is very important, that space does work in two kinds of ways. Now, the surprise is that when we apply this to very, very different and much bigger cities, we tend to find the same kind of global pattern, in spite of the fact that the local patterns are extremely different. Those two cities I showed you are a completely regular North African Roman implantation and the town of Konya in the middle of Turkey. Both have this deep structure, if you like, of the deformed wheel. We find it in London. We find it in Tokyo, in even more rich form. We find a wheel with several rims, in fact, which I see is picked up by this analysis. So you won't ask me, I can tell you that it's also found in Venice, if you analyse it, with the integration core going from the area just below the Rialto Bridge down over the Academia Bridge through St. Mark's Square and up towards the railway station. So when we look at this, we seem to find patterns which are surprisingly similar to each other, at least at the global level. And if we take four geometrically very different cities, The Hague, Atlanta, Manchester, and Shiraz in Iran, we find that in spite of the hugely different local geometries of the cities, and their different fine-scale structures, they all approximate a deformed wheel at the whole city scale when analysed in this way. So how then can this odd pattern of local differences but global similarities arise, bearing in mind the distributed nature of, over time of the process of city construction? Looking at the evidence of movement and land use patterns, it seems clearly to arise from the parallel operation of two distinct space-generating processes. A public space process, which is more or less an invariant expression of microeconomic activity, working globally because it seeks to maximise co-presence and gives rise to the global pattern of space, linking edge to centre. And a residential process, which is a variable expression of spatial culture, working locally because it tends to constrain and structure co-presence and forms the background of more homogeneous background space of the city. As a result of this, cities tend to have similarities as well as differences. The similarities are in the local to global form of public space, usually approximating the deformed wheel. And that's because, I believe, the laws governing the microeconomic activities which go on in these spaces are pretty much the same. The differences are in the local background areas, where cultural differences are in play. Now, to illustrate this, we can actually take the historic centre of Nicosia, where two different cultures produce very different background patterns in their different parts of the city. For example, this is the Turkish quarter up here. This is the historic Greek quarter down here. And we can see that the very different geometry and syntax of those two areas, reflecting, if you like, the cultural differences between those groups. But nevertheless, we find the overall structure of the city still has this powerful deformed wheel form, linking the edge to centre and defining the interstitial residential areas. Now, from this, we can see that space works in two modes. What I call a generative mode, in which space is configured to maximise co-presence and potential relations, and a conservative mode, in which space is configured to restrain and structure co-presence in order to reproduce existing cultural patterns. I think it's quite fundamental that cities are doing both these two things at once. These then seem to be generic forms which social and economic activity impose on space. But how can this incur in a distributed process spread over a long period of time with constant change in the background and constant changes to the personnel and agencies who construct and use the city? In such a differentiated and changing system, how can emergent realities be accounted for? It seems that knowledgeable agents or agencies know something and know something pretty general. So having seen what it is we're trying to explain, I now want to turn to what I think of as the two processes by which cities are created. And I will argue that there are two processes which proceed in parallel. The first is a grid-generating process by which the accumulation of building forms an emergent grid, and a city-creating process by which an aggregate of buildings turns into a living city. First, we must understand the emergence of the urban grid. In fact, there is a whole class of cell growth processes which, beginning with single-cell buildings attached to an external space by an entrance, generate the basic topology of the urban grid, that is, outward-facing islands of space, islands of built form, defining linear spaces which form networks of intersecting rings. The trouble is, this looks nothing like a real city. And the reason it doesn't is that they completely lack the geometry of the city, although they had the basic topological form. In fact, looking at the axial maps that seem to capture the logic of these dual processes so well, just showing how unlifelike it is as a real city, although it's generating the sort of kind of thing that we're looking for. If we look again at Nicosia and look at the differences between areas, for example, these differences, which seem to capture the cultural differences so well, are made of nothing but differences in the lengths of lines, the angles of intersection, and how far lines tend to end stop on each other or pass through each other. You can see lines end stop on each other much more, and they're shorter. The angles of intersection are different, in a different range to the way they are. It's almost as though culture sets a kind of the geometry of the local pattern. So what kind of a geometrical process can intervene in this basic topological process to generate the grids with the properties we found, and how can it have been implemented by knowledgeable subjects? In fact, theoretically, there could be an extremely simple answer to this. Knowledgeable subjects could be simply applying the law of spatial centrality that I set out earlier on. Since it's not obvious what I mean, I must explain a little. The simplest form of the centrality law, by which a centrally placed object blocks visibility and movement more than a peripherally placed one, is the line. If we partition a line in the centre, we reduce overall visibility from all points to all others to a maximum. And as we move it to the edge, we increase the total visibility in the system. You can actually try this and count it if you like. The area stays the same, but the total amount of intervisibility of the spaces increases as you move the partition from edge to center. Again, it's a simple spatial law, but it seems to have huge. Similarly, if we have two buildings and we want to place another building somewhere in between the two buildings, then it makes a huge difference whether we place it in the center between the two buildings and then create the two lines of the lines of the same length, in which case we maximize the added journey time that has to be spent in going from all points to all others, compared to if we put it close to one of the buildings, leaving a long line and a short line. Now, this has huge implications for how we place buildings to create a reasonably integrated system of space in a situation where every new building must block some potential lines. It means that two lines of equal length will actually create segregation in the emergent system, while two lines that are unequal as in length as possible will tend to integrate. This is not obvious at all. You know, two same length lines, you know, will not produce the same integration of the system as a very long line and a very short line, even though the total length of the two is the same. Now, this implies that if we make a cell aggregate in which every added built form will inevitably block something, then a few long lines and many short lines will be the most efficient way of doing it. And this is exactly what we find in cities all over the world, including American cities. They are invariably made up of a very small number of long lines and a very large number of short ones. It's not obvious, but it's true because we've counted. If we then experiment with different rules for deciding where to place buildings, either to conserve lines or block them, we can begin to generate outcomes which are either at one extreme as unlike cities as they could be. This is a process in which we maximize, you know, metric distance from all points to all others while preserving the topology by always blocking long lines wherever they appear. And here we have a process which does the opposite, as you always try and conserve long lines. And we can begin to experiment with these ways of intervening, if you like, in this random process of growth. And we find that by far the most efficient way to generate the basic form of a city is to decide always to conserve locally longer lines at the expense, if necessary, of many short ones. In other words, to apply the spatial law I've described in a pretty minimal way. Now, this does not account for the actual differences we find in the residential grids, but it does seem to account for the dual process, which seems invariant in cities, in that both sides of the dual process are being produced by, producing two sets of lines, which will create a dual system, one a global system of longer lines with more connections, and the other a more localized system, a more background system of shorter lines. It does seem to account for this dual process, and does seem to suggest that although we need to set the parameters differently to generate the actual differences we find in culturally determined local residential patterns, this simple generic principle, exploiting one of the most basic of spatial laws, is sufficient to account for what we might call the generic as opposed to the specific form of cities. Moreover, if this is true, it solves the problem of different agents distributed in space and time. All we need is knowledgeable agents that intuitively know the same thing, the emergent spatial effects of different kinds of physical moves in the city. We can conjecture then that common sense knowledge of laws which are in themselves mathematical is how the knowledgeable subject intervenes, driven by social objectives, to create the generic form of the city. In this way, we find the patterns across time and space are coming across in a consistent way. So agents need to know how to use space to act generatively and conservatively, and this is what I think we do. Now, this implies that the process of grid generation involves three factors: a lawful physical process, whereby a certain topology emerges from cell aggregation processes, something like cognitive agents, knowledgeable with if-then knowledge about using built form to generate generative or conservative space, and social factors, which we've not dealt with in detail, but which make the precise settings of the geometrical parameters by different cultures construct their residential space. But always we must bear in mind that the burden of implementation of these must be due to knowledgeable agents. So simply as grids, it seems, cities are complex mixes of physical processes with physical laws, cognitive laws and spatial laws, if you like, and cultural factors. But most of all, they're a mixture of physical and mental process, I think, each reflecting in its own way something which is in its own domain lawful. Now, this is how grids are generated, and this is the first of the two parallel processes, which I argue is the means by which cities are created. The second process turns the aggregate of built forms into the living city. So first, consider this figure here. We unexpectedly suddenly gone indoors, but it's such a nice graphic, I thought I'd show it to you. The figure on the left shows 100 people entering the Tate Britain Gallery down in Millbank and moving around for 10 minutes. On the right is a visual field analysis of the plan of the gallery, showing the pattern of visual integration in the layout of the gallery, with red for integration through to blue for segregation. Now, I'm showing this because the similarity between the two patterns is very striking. And if we actually regress movement rates in each space against the mathematical values which the colours represent, we find an R square of about 0.74. In other words, about three quarters of the differences between the objective actual movement rates of individuals, three quarters of the differences between movement rates reflects differences in the visual integration space of the space in the buildings. Now, this points us in the direction of what I believe to be the most important and fundamental consequence of spatial configuration, and perhaps the only one, that through its structure, spatial configuration shapes a pattern of movement and therefore a pattern of co-presence among people. This, I believe, is what space does, and it may be all it does. Let me try and convince you of this empirically. Let me return to our map of London. This is the in which I've highlighted five areas where we've observed every line segment between junctions, the movement rate of vehicles and pedestrians right through the working day, a total of over 400 observed segments of space. It's a very, very rich and very, very dense database. And what we're going to do is simply look at the integration values which are associated with the colouring of this map, which are derived purely from the mathematical analysis of the grid, and the actual observed movement rates we find. Now these are, on the horizontal axis, is a variable which we call local integration. It actually measures our integration variable, not from each line to all the others, but each line to up to a certain distance away, which measures what we call the local grid conditions surrounding each line. Now, these correlations are far from perfect, but considering we're looking at the effect of one single variable, a spatial configuration variable, they are quite extraordinarily good. This is not a traffic engineer's model, and we're not interested in adding the other factors, the degree of attraction of shops, proximity of transport termini, and so on, as a traffic engineer would, because what we're interested in is the impact of spatial configuration itself on movement. As you can see in these cases, and has been demonstrated in a very large number of studies, the relation is very strong indeed, and we can assert that to the degree that built forms are more or less evenly distributed throughout the grid, and to the degree that movement is from all points to all others, then the greatest influence on movement flows will be the structure of the grid itself. Now, we call this movement generated by the grid natural movement. And to the extent that movement flows are structured by spatial configuration, inside or outside building, as opposed to specific attractors, you know, like the shops and like the tube stations, then we say we have a pattern of natural movement. And it follows that to the extent that the urban grid creates a pattern of movement through its configuration. It also creates a pattern of natural co-presence and co-awareness among people. Now, as I said, I think this is what space does, and it may be all it does, because all the other effects of space that we've discovered on land use patterns or on crime patterns, for example, seem to be downwind of this fundamental relationship. It's a relationship, I think, of immense power. It means that how we structure grids creates the basic conditions of co-presence in the everyday mind, in the everyday domain. It creates a kind of virtual co-presence community. Now, although this has been demonstrated in numerous studies, space syntax studies, a lot of people have problems with this relationship because for some people it sounds like 1960s spatial determinism. Others say it's too simple. They haven't heard of Occam's razor. But in fact, there are two very simple reasons why this fundamental relationship between spatial configuration and movement shouldn't surprise us. The first is common sense. Let's look at this simple notional grid that I've made here, analyzed according to the pattern of integration. And imagine that all the houses, all the streets, are lined with buildings on both sides, and that people move from all houses to all other houses. It's quite clear that the main street will get more movement passing through, as well as being a more accessible destination than other spaces. And it's also clear that there will be a gradation of spaces, that this one will have less than that one, for example, although that one's quite a bit longer than that one. I'm suggesting it's actually common sense in looking at simple examples, and we'll also find an effect where the central parts of the grid will get more movement than the peripheral parts of the grid. Common sense says we must expect to find this relationship. And all we're saying is that if we have a grid as complex as London, we would expect to find it as well. The second reason why we should believe in this is mathematical. There is a theorem in a branch of mathematics called Markov chain theory, which shows that random movement, one-step movement in any graph, that is any system of elements and links, will lead to cumulative visits to nodes going to a limit directly proportional to the degree or connectivity of the node. An amazingly simple emergent effect in even the most complex systems. So mathematically, it would be very surprising if there was not a pretty good relationship between grid configuration and movement. What should surprise us here is that the correlation is not with the connectivity of lines, which is a purely local property of the line, but with a higher, more order measure of the relation of the line to its local grid conditions. The implication is that although the grid is generated bottom-up and experienced bottom-up in that one must move around it to build up a picture of it, in terms of how the emergent grid affects movement, the effect is top-down. Movement is structured by the configuration of the grid as an emergent whole. Now, this, again, is empirically demonstrated, and I think we have to come to terms with it. Now, since all movement is by individual cognitive subjects, we have to assume them to be, in some sense, knowledgeable subjects in terms of the grid. So just as the knowledgeable cognitive subject intervened in the basic physical process to create the geometry of the grid out of its topology, so once again, we find the subject intervenes to, as it were, in building a synchronized picture of a grid which is experienced only bit by bit, and using this to construct a pattern of movement. So the passage, if you like, from this turnaround from bottom-up creation of the grid to its top-down influence on movement patterns must pass through knowledgeable agents. Now, this is a particularly important because the relationship between grid configuration and movement sets off the process by which an aggregate of buildings becomes a living city. It's set off by the impact of the spatial configuration on movement because this produces another emergent pattern. That is a range of movement-rich and movement-poor locations resulting from the local configurational inequalities in the urban grid. Each line has its own integration value, by which it's related to all others, and it's this value, if you like, which describes its relationship to the rest of the system, is what defines its role in natural movement. Now, once we have this, once we have, if you like, the urban grid creating patterns of movement which are rich in some parts and poor in others, this then becomes a framework within which land use processes, which themselves are driven by social economic factors, select sites according to the need for activities to be closer to or farther from movement. thus retail-type activities, will naturally migrate to movement-rich locations, while residents will not and may even seek movement-poor locations. Again, we can check this out statistically, as we did with movement, by checking, in this case, the distribution of every shop all over Camden and beginning to look for the spatial factors which correlate with this. And again, we can find spatial factors enormously powerful. Again, the local grid conditions factors in generating the distribution of shops and land uses. Now, from here, the migration of movement-seeking land uses to movement-rich locations then produces multiplying effects by attracting more movement to those locations, which then attract other, often more diverse land uses and other specialities, which reflect the increasing concentration of different uses at that location, thus creating denser mixed-use areas against a background of more homogeneous areas. Where this process becomes more intensive, it then feeds back onto the local structure of the grid, usually by intensifying it to create the smaller scale grids that we find in the local centres and sub-centres of cities against a background of more homogeneous residential neighbourhoods. Again, I think the area we're in here is historically actually one of these locations of intensified grids in the city, and it still survives and serves, if you like, a university as well as it served its original functioning. So this is how, if you like, we arise at a picture of a city which has, if you like, is a patchwork of stronger attractor areas and linear connections between them against a background of more homogeneous residential space. Now this is why we're able to make spatial analyses, because this program is generated by the, or set off by the shaping of the grid. This is why in taking an analysis of a city like London, the analysis seems, which is, even though it's a purely spatial analysis, it seems to tell us an awful lot of functional information about where things are, where centres are, where shops are, where the main movement lines are, and I would suggest even how we find our way around London, picking out these yellow routes, the way we find ourselves, our ways from Platts Lane to Chalk Farm or something like that, along these sinuous routes, are all picked up by this analysis. So this is what I mean by the city creating process, set off by the grid, influence on movement, then on land uses, and then grid intensification. It tells us, if you like, how the urban grid generates the urban buzz, but also tells how the city comes to be a seamless network of busy and quiet zones, each merging naturally with its neighbours. This then is how the social city creates the physical city. But on reflection, it is no longer enough to call it the social city, because the means by which the social has been imposed on the spatial has been the knowledgeable subject, knowledgeable of something like spatial laws, if then laws, of what is the effect of doing this. We can surely say then that the knowledgeable subject creates the generic city in terms of what all cities have in common, while it is society that creates the different city. We must then, I think, add the concept of the human city to that of the social city. The human city provides the limits within which the social city can be formed. The human subject, I believe, defines the generic city, and society then shapes that within the limits set by this process. So this is the general theory of the city as object and how the social and physical cities come to be related. The theory shows that under the surface complexity, there is actually quite a lot of simplicity, as is so often found in complex emergent systems. But there's also aspects of this complexity which are not found in current models, in that the universal aspect of the process seems to be due to the intervention of knowledgeable subjects making choices and taking local decisions which shape the pattern of the emergent whole. In this sense, the model is more complex than the kind of system we're used to thinking about, and we have to reflect, I think, on the paradigmatic implications of this. But the story does not quite end here. There are further emergent social effects from the process we've described. In doing its work, the city-creating process also creates everywhere well-defined patterns of everyday co-presence of people, which I've suggested we can think of as a kind of virtual community of co-presence, prior to any interaction or any structure being imposed on it and created by the city itself. Now, we can measure the density, composition, and spatial distribution of these virtual communities, which we find in different areas, by simply regressing the number of people in each space, or the number of types of people in each space against each other. The more different types of people use space similarly, for example, supposing we're sort of looking at how men and women use space, if these are all the spaces and they're using space in the same way, we'll find a simple linear correlation. If people are using spaces in quite different ways, supposing men are using some spaces and women are using others, we'll find a kind of an L-shaped effect. So we can actually investigate the density and social composition, if you like, of these virtual co-presence communities simply by using some simple statistical tools. We can actually look at, for example, this is comparing the pattern of movement of tourists against office workers in a part of the fringe of the City of London where we're working on a current project. And you can see they're using space in different ways. This is looking at male and female movement in an inner part of the City of London during the working day. And this is looking at it in the evening, and it tells us there's some process we don't understand because, you know, there are whole kinds of many spaces where women are suddenly beginning to be in numbers greater than men. So we can simply use this, if you like, as a way of investigating this, another of these tacit things that we are aware of but don't know how to talk about. Now, what we find when we do this is that in ordinary street-based urban areas, we find the virtual co-presence community is made up of what we call multiple interfaces, in that all types of people, inhabitants and strangers, men and women, adults and children, old people and others, all use the space in similar ways and thus create a certain density and structure in the virtual community. Now, I suspect that these everyday patterns matter quite a lot, since it seems to be these pervasive patterns of natural co-presence which gives us the elementary sense of security and civility that comes with urban life. If this is so, we should see these patterns of co-presence as a social resource in themselves, not simply as something which may be prior to interaction or structure in the community. They are not, I think, the source of society, but they are a source of our sense of feeling secure and belonging to society in the everyday spatial domains in which we live. The more successful we are, of course, the less we depend on this, but I suspect that no one is ever completely free from this. Under certain kinds of urban conditions in particular, these patterns of co-presence seem to play a key role in our sense of security and therefore our sense of being in a social domain. Again, we're dealing here with a non-discursive configurational reality. We sense it, but we don't know how to talk about it, and we're trying to find out how to talk about this in the same way as we try to find out how to talk about spatial configurations. Now, the importance to everyday life of these open and changing virtual communities in the continuous space of the city is, I believe, evidenced by what seem to be the consequences of their loss on some of our housing estates. Here we show, this is the old King's Cross site, and this is a number of housing estates around the edges, and I'm going to briefly mention that one, because it shows a very typical spatial pattern, quite unlike, if you like, the generic kinds of forms of London space we find here. We find a pattern which is highly complex and apparently structureless, and it forms a clump of segregation, insulated from the rest of the urban fabric, and with very highly scaled down spaces. Now, we can measure the density and structure of the co-presence communities on many of these estates, because this one at least is a very worrying place. Within 3.5 years of being opened, it was to being widely praised. It was described by the police as a ticking time bomb, and we have to understand how these processes take place. Is it just the management? Is it the bad families? Or is there some kind of spatial dimension to this process? Well, what we do find is that on estates like this, two things happen with remarkable regularity. First, there is a reduction by a whole order of magnitude, that is by a factor of 10, in the basic adult-to-adult encounter rate. Literally, you're only one-tenth as likely to encounter an adult in space as you are in even an ordinary, fairly quiet street system. If you couple this to the radical downscaling of space, the effect is that where in an ordinary street-based area, you are naturally co-present with more than one adult for over 90% of the time. In the housing estate, with its scaled-down and segregated spaces, you're likely to be alone in space for most of the time. of course, there are no strangers passing naturally through. So when one appears, usually rather suddenly because of the scaling of the space, it is unexpected and even a source of anxiety and fear. Now, the second thing that happens is because the estate is spatially overly complex and fragmented and doesn't have a dominant pattern which organizes movement, different types of people moving around for different reasons and from different locations find them using space in different ways. Even men and women begin to tend towards the L-shaped pattern. But worst of all, when we begin to look at the pattern of adults and children, we find them completely separated in the spatial configuration. So there's no longer any natural surveillance of children by everyday adult movement as there is in the street system. To make matters worse, as we've measured, the density of children in spaces is twice as high. And they form larger groups, meaning that you go from a system in the streets where adults outnumber children throughout the space by about 10 to 1. And here the children outnumber the adults by 2 to 1, as well as forming larger groups. Now, the net effect of this transformation of the virtual community on the spatial design of the estate is to replace, I suggest, a sense of security and ordinary everyday civility that comes from the natural co-presence of others with one of fear. In terms of its social effects, this fear may be worse than actual crime, since it removes from everyday life the basic spatial condition of feeling a member of society, that is, being spatially secure in the presence of others. To be afraid in space, as you almost invariably are on our worst estates, is not simply a psychological condition, it is a social condition. And I suspect that it's sometimes what we mean when we talk about social breakdown on the estate. It is not a breakdown of structures, but an effect on individuals of the loss of a sense of the natural co-presence that makes us feel spatially and therefore in part socially secure. Once again, we find that the relation of urban space to society is mediated by individual subjects. Now, I thought a lot about this kind of virtual community, the co-presence community, because it's not something that features in social science. I mean, sociology begins with interaction. But I'm very persuaded by my studies of housing estates where fear has become such a dominant factor, even when there isn't even a crime rate to support that level of fear. I believe we're talking about something which is more fundamental about how we use and create and orientate ourselves in space. But this does remind us, and learning that we can change this so dramatically by changing design, it does lead us to reflect on the social value and function of streets. I think a simple way of putting this is I think the streets are interesting social phenomena. They're so close to us, we don't think about them. They don't reflect society. On the contrary, they put together into natural patterns of everyday co-presence what society divides. The relationship of spatial configuration, I say, is not just to reflect the social, but it's somehow to within reasonable limits, to overcome it. There is a kind of universal culture of the street, which is so natural to us, but we are, in the manner of culture, never aware of its presence. It's in the way we do things. No one has rights above anyone else in the street. Good streets, I think, are the most everyday and therefore the most pervasive evidence that we live in society and are part of it. This awareness does not depend on structure. In a sense, it is rather like a profane version of Victor Turner's communitas with its anti-structure connotations. It negates structure and is based on simple civilized co-presence. So I believe that there are, if you like, the simple effect of space doesn't just, through its configuration, generate movement and affect the land use pattern and the multiplier effects in generating the city. I believe that the actual co-presence patterns that are made by this are important dimensions of the way in which the city functions as a social object, and the way in which individuals identify themselves as social individuals within it. We should see this, I think, as a social resource, even if it doesn't need to interaction or structure in the community. So in the light of much 20th century experience, we suspect the more the city-creating process is allowed to operate, the better the city seems to be. It seems to be why we suspect that organic cities are often, though not always, better than planned ones. But I think it's important that we see the plan of the city not as simply a physical pattern. It is a record of a historical process and contains many of the secrets of that process in its very form. It follows that we should no longer see the urban grid simply as an inert background to human activity, but both as a historical record of a city-creating process driven by human activity and as a potential driving force for future development. The more we take this into account, and we now have a UCL spin-off company called Space Syntax Limited, which is applying these ideas on about 50 projects a year, the more we should be able to make the new parts of cities draw life from and give life to the old. So this then is the theory of the city as a physical spatial object and how it's been generated out of the raw material of human action and human thought against a background of physical processes. And this is why I think cities as they are as they are rather than otherwise. But if this theory is in any sense, you know, on the right lines, I think a number of consequences follow, which I think are very important and very simple. First, in terms of how it is constructed in cities, space does not work in endlessly complex ways to reflect the idiosyncrasies of human action. It works essentially in two opposed ways along the same dimension. As I've said, the generative mode, in which space is configured to maximize co-presence and potential relations, and a conservative mode in which space is configured to restrain and structure co-presence, and all grades in between them. And this is what is done, if you like, but what I call the knowledge of laws of my knowledgeable agents. And it's because space is engineered along this dimension, if you like, rather than on dimensions of endless complexity, that knowledgeable subjects are able to intervene and shape the city over very long periods of time in a generically consistent, though dual, way. Now, it follows from this that the relation of social activity to spatial patterning in cities is generic, not specific. It is not the specific activities that create the dual patterns of settlement space, but the generic demands that different kinds of activity place on movement and co-presence, which form space somewhere on the spectrum from generative to conservative. This is why in cities space changes slowly while activity changes rapidly. New activities fit into existing patterns of space according to the distribution of demands they make on patterns of co-presence. I think this is the fundamental relationship between space and activity, and it's a great error to try to model the city in terms of specific patterns of activity because the whole thing passes through this generic relationship with movement. Now, one implication of this, if it's right, is quite simple, that cities will continue to work for the new emerging societies, because just as over the last 300 years in the City of London, for example, we've seen a city which has transformed from being a centre of face-to-face activity and business to something where everybody operates on computers, but still we find the space supporting a different version, if you like, a more cultural version of the kind of rich spatial life that we find in the City of London. Now, the third conclusion is that space is not infinitely plastic in responding to social forces. Too many of our theories assume that if you can define the social process, then you define the space. It's not the case. Space has its own laws, its own limitations, and answers back to society through well-defined mechanisms. And through this, space plays a constructive as well as a receptive role in constructing living cities. It is not a one-way street from society to space. Finally, we have to say that, you know, if cities are created by a process that involves physical laws of aggregation, spatial laws, and all these factors, then we can't dispense with any of these if we wish to understand the city. Certainly the spatial and the cognitive have to be set inside the physical and economic modelling that tends to prevail at the moment. So, in the light of this theory, I'd like to suggest that to the LSE's Cities programme that it opens up two significant possibilities. First, that of building space into social science research by putting measures and indices of the spatial and material conditions of everyday life on an equivalent numerical footing to social, economic, and demographic variables, and thus bring social science closer to the synthesis between the everyday and institutional aspects of society, which we would all like to see. We've begun to do this recently, for example, in a recent study of spatial, social, and demographic development in Santiago, we were able to bring spatial factors and land use factors and many other kind of factors which are connected with movement and the kind of materiality of the everyday pattern of life to bear on a study of how informal settlements had developed over two or three decades in outlying parts of Santiago in Chile. Now, by the simple means of being able to express these material factors, these spatial factors of everyday life in a quantitative way, we could bring them into the multivariate analysis, and we could actually solve the problem and show the reason why some settlements were much better than others, why some had become quite desirable places to live and others, self-built settlements, had tended to become sort of frightening places and drug havens. It was essentially the design and integration of the urban grid into the local spatial system was turned out to be a powerful determinant of how far informal commercial activity was able to intervene in a local regional economy rather than the purely internal one, which was the case with the worst. So we could actually find spatial factors which seemed to be having a strong long-term effect on how those city areas were developing. And we could work with social scientists, as we did, in trying to put a whole picture of the material conditions and the social conditions and the economic conditions together into a single framework. The second thing, I think, over and above bringing space into social science, I think is bringing social science and design. As I've said, there's now a UCL spin-off company called Space Syntax, which applies these ideas. And the way we do it is, on any site, we first of all make syntax models of the area around the site to be developed. Then we observe its functioning in detail. Then we correlate our functional observations with our spatial model. And if it works reasonably well, and it usually does, then we can use the same space syntax model as we use to research the area in design in simulation mode and design mode, simply by sketching different candidate designs into the model and looking for the configurational effects of the design on the context, how the context will affect the site and how the site will affect the context. Now, I believe this process of intervening in design has just begun in looking at basic movement and land use factors, but I think it has much greater potential to draw on social, economic, demographic, and even crime data in the design process. Now, as I said at the start, space syntax was first developed as a means to allow the social and the spatial to communicate in design, and this is how I would see it working. Thanks very much.
Extremely succinct and precise outline of not only where, how you've traveled to here and where you want to take it further, or more to the point to tell us of the city's program where we should take the lines further, which I've noted, and I'm not sure whether I can respond right now. We do have a microphone, a roving microphone, and I'd be delighted if some of you would like to ask Bill some questions relating to his presentation. If you do that, could I please ask you to wait for the microphone and tell us who you are? That would be useful and helpful. Are there any questions you'd like to ask? There's one down at the end.
Michael McLean from Ergotonic. With cities as they have become in the 21st century, do you think we have any escape from capitalism without being radical?
So the question, did you hear that? The question is something like, cities of the 21st century, can they escape from capitalism? More or less? Is that a relevant question?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think I understand the question. I thought the situation where we were in at the moment, we had no idea what the alternative might be. I certainly don't know. I would hope to come to this place for enlightenment about this rather than to tell you about it. I'm a narrow specialist.
If there are other hands here, one at the back and one at the front here. First row and at the back. Can we have the microphone?
Hi, I'm sure you've been asked these questions very often, but to what extent does it matter that common spatial form to cities may represent really different uses across different cities? So the map you showed us of Atlanta, you could imagine downtown Atlanta empty at night, able to bring people together, but doesn't. So I'm kind of interested in why you want to show some trans-historical truth about spatial form of cities. And I also, my other question is about the role that knowledgeable human agents play versus the obvious political and broader social processes that are producing these forms. So no individual ever produced a long street. It was the government, policymakers, and so on. So, and I'm sure you've been asked those questions a lot. I'm just curious to hear your answer.
Well, let me answer the second one first. I am actually quite deliberately saying that we talk about, you know, political agencies working, but how political agencies act depend on how they understand the system, and this really depends on some consensus among individuals about how the system they're intervening in works. I'm pointing to the, you know, the primacy of the, or the important role of the, if you like, of the human individual. I mean, it's strange for me because I've always been, you know, I've always been a society space person. It's only recently I've really come to face the necessity of understanding this. But the point I'm making is that we see, if you like, the city has certain generic aspects to its shaping, which I've tried to describe. In spite of its highly variable geometry, it has certain generic things in common, and it has certain powerful differences. I'm really asking, by what possible mechanism can the hugely varying agencies and social factors and individuals who create this over a long period of time, how on earth can these consistent effects actually happen? And I'm arguing that it's to do with how individuals, how we understand space as individuals. It's this that informs the means by which we create an image of society in space by making sort of space in different kind of areas reflect different kinds of cultural mores. But it's using this basic dimension, if you like, of the ability of space to generate or restrict a kind of an emergent pattern of co-presence. So I'm suggesting that has to be related to how we understand space as human beings. There is a human side to the city as well as a social side. I think this is one of the reasons why all the attempts to try to describe socialism or fascism in terms of cities have really failed, because really everything passes through this generic kind of relationship. Cities are not so differentiated. And that really takes me to the second question. The first question, you ask about very different patterns of activity and the fact that the centre of Atlanta is empty, which it is, of course. Here I was talking there about a pattern of growth, and Atlanta is actually a very, very special case and a very special social background, which has been studied and, you know, which does work spatially in the kind of way, although at a relatively restricted level. But really, I'm taking as my starting point. I think that... when you're trying to understand something, for example, the relationship between activity and space, then one tends to put the difficult bits on the edge of your vision and concentrate on what seem to be the easy bits. I'm trying to bring the difficult bits to the centre by saying, the fact is, there seems to be only the most marginal relationship between human activity and space. And almost everywhere we experience cities completely change the nature of the activities that go on in them. But the city still goes on working in a good and useful way. Buildings do the same kind of thing. Buildings which are very carefully designed for one kind of organisation are then taken over by another, who with comparatively minimal changes make it work for them. I think we have to start from this fundamental fact that the relation of human activity to space is generic, and it really all depends on the way in which what we're doing relates to the presence of others, if you like, or the potential presence of others through movement. This is what shapes the city, and it's one level down from the specific pattern of activity that we're trying to mirror, if you like, in a design when we're designing a building. It's something which is at a lower level. It says there are certain kinds of space patterns which seem to be able to absorb almost any kind of pattern of human activity by distributing themselves within it. Does that answer the question?
Peter, I know, has a question in a moment. there on the left. But Bill, can I just take that point a moment? Because if, as you argue very strongly, there is, and you stress this point, that a generic relationship between spatial patterns and patterns of movement and therefore co-presence, could that still not be seen? And I notice you used the term in a sort of nearly in self-defense, and I'm bringing it out on purpose here at the LSE. Could not that be inferred to be a sort of second-order form of spatial determinism insofar? And if so, there's nothing. I think there is nothing wrong with that. But in a way, I'm slightly confused as to whether you're arguing that there is a relation of which determines co-presence and therefore potential social behavior. On the other hand, you're sort of standing back from that. Maybe
no, I'm not standing back from that. No, I'm saying we have to come to terms with this. I mean, I'm actually trying to suggest the precise mechanism by which, you know, the creation of spatial configurations is not empty as far as its consequences for people is concerned. The effects are generic. They're not specific in the sense that, you know, that we create a necessary relationship between this activity and that activity. But I sometimes talk about the illusion of the plan. The plan of a building appears to be a static distribution of activities in different spaces. But what we mean by the functioning of that plan is not what goes on in the spaces, but how they connect to each other through the emergent pattern of movement and contact which it develops in there. So I think this is always there. And it seems to me, both mathematically, in common sense terms, and powerfully empirically, that the effect of space on people is largely mediated through one single factor, and that is the powerful determining effect of spatial configuration on patterns of movement, and therefore on patterns of co-presence. And I think that's what we manipulate in design. We're actually unconsciously manipulating this, not this activity or that. We're manipulating these patterns and these potential patterns of contact and co-presence in relation to those activities, and that's why the whole thing is generic rather than specific.
Hello, Bill. I'm very interested in the question of wealth, influence, and power.
Can you keep it a bit
further away?
Or
is that okay?
Better.
Thank you. I'm very interested in questions of wealth, influence, and power in relation to your analysis of the city or parts of the city. If you stretch your imagination, the example and the analysis you gave in part of Maiden Lane, for instance, and you imagine an alternative scenario where, for reasons which we can imagine, Maiden Lane is suddenly bought up and becomes a haven of the wealthy. And a number of things begin to happen as a result of that change of wealth in relation to property, and that property's relation to the particular neighborhood. I wonder whether you could comment on whether something which I understood you to say was pretty inherently structurally problematic might suddenly no longer be perceived within the culture that grows from that new condition to be problematic any longer.
This is a very good question. This is what I meant when I was talking about, if you like, the generic city. And I talked about, if you like, microeconomic activity generating a fairly universalistic global pattern of space. And then culture generates a much more specific and differentiated pattern of spaces between Turkish and Greek communities, for example, or maybe between rich and poor. But nearly in all cities have this residential culture in some form or the other. Now, in that region of the city, I'm quite sure that what the patterning of space is in the image of the form of social coherence, you know, what you are trying to do in order to reproduce those particular kind of social relations. Now, in terms of the differences between social classes, I mean, there is a kind of a central paradox in space, I think. I mean, if you see the city as a kind of a wealth-creating mechanism, that when you make wealth, you seek to segregate yourself from the city. You become a person, if you like, whose networks are not in any sense dependent on space. They become what I call transpatial kind of networks. I live in the Barbican. I know, sort of how these societies work and how very, very pleasant these sort of single-class sort of societies can be. But I think that there's no doubt at all that one of the things we have to explain and understand is that when a different group of people moves into that housing estate, you know, it does actually change its nature, because then it's not relating to the forms of everyday living of one group of people and the dependencies those people have. It refers to the pattern of everyday living of another, people whose networks are across space, if you like, not dependent on the local neighbourhood. Now, whether this would work in Maiden Lane or not, I don't know, because I think there could be the design of Maiden Lane is such a broken up space. It's such an extraordinary design, a very beautiful design in many ways. I mean, but I'm not sure. I simply don't know whether a very different group of people can make that work. I do know that if you moved a few thousand problem families into the Barbican, it would become a nightmare to live in. And, the spatial nature of your spatial culture, if you like, interacts with the spatial nature of your surroundings to determine whether it works or not.
If that's so, then what does it say about the generic characteristics that by analysis yes. describe the particular pattern?
I think if we had nothing but Maiden Lanes, we'd have a very, very strange place.
Theoretically, if you like, since we haven't picked it up, then it's good. Yeah.
Well, of course, it changes completely. City spaces run on the dual process. And it's the residential culture which is most sensitive, if you like, to difference and to cultural differences. In fact, I go as far as to say I'm trying to make my theory acknowledge that difficulty right in the outset by the way in which I'm trying to model what's going on. I think there are certain universalistic aspects to cities, but they're not the parts that respond to the particular cultural forces which lead us to shape residential space in one way or the other. I also think this is not fixed. I think these changes. I think most people I know were brought up in one space culture, if you like, one domestic space culture, but now live in another. I think these things are, you know, almost change with fashion, if you like, and certainly in my own life history, I've been through a whole series of changes in this. So I don't see culture as something which is fixed, but I do say that when we try to match, if you like, the spatial culture of a people with the actual system of physical space in which they live, we will actually be looking at these generic relationships rather than something which is actually more specific and more detailed. So I think the relationship.
A few more questions in. One at the back. There? Yes? Max.
My name is Max Steuer. I'm in the Cities program. When congestion charges come in London, one would expect that the pattern of usage will change. And I wonder if you could give some idea of how your analysis might help us to answer a couple of questions, say, are congestion charges a good idea or not? And where should they be, what area of the city should they cover in order to achieve a better outcome? I mean, I don't know whether your analysis can address that kind of issue, or whether it, perhaps you could.
Well,
this is, of course, a trick question from Max Thorpe.
I hope it does. I hope it does, because we're just getting a research grant to study exactly that.
But?
Isn't that a little late?
But I don't... No, what we want to do is to study the effects of this on the land use patterns. I mean, I don't know the answer. It's like the question about capitalism. I simply don't know the answer to that. But I mean, we do know how to research it. I mean, you know, by this combination of very close in observation, detailed mapping and spatial analysis, you can begin, you know, over time to begin to see the effect of these changes. In fact, one of our fundamental research areas at the moment is the shifting nature of city neighbourhoods.
Okay. Let's take two very brief, short questions, one here and one here.
Yes, Nick Jeffrey, Open University. As this is the LSE, we'll go back to some basics. You showed us a picture of a beach.
Keep your arms to yourself.
There were three houses. Two and one. When it moved to the edge, this
What's
was
your question?
This was Nick? The grouping. This was the most interaction.
The object in the space.
Right. the objects in space, three right. objects. And so generically you're saying you're going to get the most interaction and say one of those three moves towards one other and they're not evenly distributed.
No, I said the spatial, the effect of the decision of where to place the building on the emergent spatial configuration is mathematical.
Okay.
It increases the... try it and see.
Okay.
Well,
there's
it increases another the total distance you have to travel.
A man named Hotelling, an economist and geographer in 1929, he proposed a beach evenly populated by people.
Yeah.
Two ice cream vendors.
I know this well. Yes,
wherever they are on the beach.
Yeah. Okay, Nick, what's the
they
question?
They would move towards each other in order to gain that market.
That's right, yeah.
Right.
So the other person, the other seller wouldn't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they ended up right together, and that would, in fact, minimize the
yeah.
enjoyment of ice cream, the sales of ice cream, the distance people would have to travel. It minimizes interaction.
Okay, Nick, can we pass the microphone?
I know this, of course, but I wasn't modelling that. What I'm showing is a purely spatial effect. There are quite independent, objective, mathematical laws of space that if you do this or do that, it produces an effect on the configuration. I think this is the foundation of architecture in a way. It's because that's what architects do. They shape objects and move objects around to create emergent effects.
Hi, I'm Helen on the Cities Programme, I'm a student. I was just a question really about sort of natural growth versus sort of humanisation of sort of used space. I was just wondering if you'd applied your integration analysis to other sort of forms of growth, sort of like rabbit warrens, for instance, or termite grounds, or even such things as spiders' webs.
No.
Or other things like that.
It's been applied to the web, it's been applied to... cognitive search structures. It's been applied to quite a lot of different areas, but not to rabbit warrens, as far as I know. and I think they may not... I don't know what they're like. I mean, are they just trees or...
I don't know. I was wondering if there would be, in that sort of animal world, it could sort of grow similar to...
That would be interesting. Well, my belief is that we are configurational beings. I mean, because we're discrete, mobile beings, we have to be good at dealing with the co-present relationships of lots of other people or lots of objects in space. I mean, and this is why it works with our unconscious mind. What we're trying to do is to bring these things up. I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, I watch lions hunting. And it's an amazingly configurational thing, the way they sort of act together. And I think it would be very interesting to try to extend this to outside the human race.
I think we should keep it within the human race at the moment. And I think that the notion, the challenge in a way at the very beginning of the fact that human beings are knowledgeable agents of space, as you said, is, I think, one of the more important thoughts that we have to deal with. And I think your presentation of the theory and the methodology and the conclusions you've reached through the research are at times controversial, people in this audience, I think incredibly rigorous. And I can certainly say at the receiving end, both as a student but also as a designer and someone seeing how certain parts of cities have been changed and modified in relation to, I'd call it this heightened knowledge of what designers are doing with their hands or on the computers, I think there's an enormous amount more to learn and more to debate. But it is incredibly useful and incredibly insightful for me, and I hope everyone else in the audience who have heard Bill Hillier talk about his notions of how space matters, which it certainly does. So will you join me in thanking Bill, and I hope he comes back in 30 years' time.